The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this June 20th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. I'm on for the full hour with the amazing Rebecca Mackay talking about a book I am confident is on its way to the bestseller list. Rebecca Mackay is the author of The Borrower, The 100-Year House, which won the Novel of the Year from Chicago Writers Association, and Music for Wartime, which she was on with me talking about in 2015. Her work has appeared in The Best American Short Stories, Harper's, and Tin House, among others, but it's her latest, The Great Believers, out yesterday and published by Viking, that we are chatting about this morning. Rebecca, welcome back.
Thank you.
So this feels like a novel that would have taken 10 years to write, but you know, given your prolific writing and the steady stream of publication and the fact that we talked 2 years ago, I know it probably couldn't have taken that long. So, you know, it just feels so grand in scope and ambitious. And so before we dive into kind of talking about the arc of it, how long did it take you to write this?
I'm really tempted to joke and tell you it was like my NaNoWriMo project. I just did it last November or something. No, it probably took, all told, it's hard to say whether it would be 4 years or 5 years. 4 years really to write it. And then this past year, of course, you're micro-tuning, you know, copy edits and things like that. Something weird with my publication history is that my story collection was actually done before my second novel was even done, even though it was my last book to appear. So the time when it would look like maybe I would have been writing my story collection, I wasn't. It was done. I was actually writing this. So, you know, 4 or 5 years, depending how you count. But they were pretty intense years. You know, I think everyone's first novel takes longer because, you know, my first novel took me 10 years because you're probably working another full-time job and you're not sure that anyone wants to read this. And it was nice, you know, with this book to have a lot of time to dedicate to it. But yeah, maybe at some point in this tour when I get really bored of answering questions, I'll try to convince someone it was a NaNoWriMo project and see what happens.
I don't think they're going to buy it, but you can try that. I think it's out. So, you know, I know none of our listeners have picked this up yet since it, you know, just came out. So I'm going to give you a chance to sort of introduce the novel, take us into this world, and set the groundwork for the rest of our chat here.
Yeah, sure. So it is, The Great Believers is largely the story of a group of friends, specifically a man named Yale Tishman, in 1980s Chicago at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And it starts with the funeral of his first close friend to die of AIDS and follows him over the next 7 years as his life both completely falls apart and also takes on much greater meaning. But meanwhile, every other chapter is set in 2015 Paris, and we're following there a woman named Fiona. It was her brother whose funeral started the book, and we're watching her as, on the surface, she's trying to find and reconnect with her estranged daughter, but circumstances conspire to really force her to finally reconcile a lot of things that happened 30 years ago to really start to come to terms with some of the grief she's been suppressing. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but those are the two main threads.
So talk a little bit about the point of origin, not into the book itself, but into the subject matter of the novel for you. How did this start? Did it start with an image? Did it start with a character? Or
yeah.
An idea?
So actually I started off wanting to write about an artist's model in 1920s Paris. Which is in the book, you know, if you read that, that won't seem that bizarre. I had this idea of, this question in my mind of, you know, as a woman, if you had wanted to be an artist, but it was a time really before women had the support and resources to necessarily be successful in a career in the arts. What would happen if you were modeling and saw being a muse as your really only artistic outlet? And I wanted to write that story. And I had this character who I figured, I wanted to write about her at the end of her life, looking back. And I figured she couldn't have lived much past the 1980s, just doing a little math. And I wanted it to be the story of this woman and the art guy, whether he was a collector or a gallery owner, I didn't know, to whom she was trying to prove that she had been the model for certain very famous paintings. That's not quite the way the storyline turned out in the book, and it, you know, it ended up being a subplot. What happened then was I figured, okay, I have an art guy in the 80s, and maybe what's going on in his life is something having to do with the AIDS epidemic. And I saw some really interesting parallels there between 1920s Paris, as World War I has really decimated an entire generation, and the late 1980s as a generation is being decimated by AIDS. And the first thing I wrote, actually, it's not in the novel, was a letter from this woman to the art guy. And neither of them had names yet. This letter that started off with, "You have to understand that everyone was dead." And that became the heart of my book. And as I did more and more research into the AIDS crisis, specifically AIDS in Chicago, where I wanted to set the book, it's where I live, that really just became the gravity of the story for me. It just kind of all dipped in that direction. And the 1920s Paris stuff became more the subplot. So yeah, it's not necessarily what you would guess, I think, looking at the finished product, but that's what happened.
I was going to say, that is so not what I expected you to say. That's exactly
that. Nope.
Well, and I do think it's interesting. I mean, I don't know your age specifically, but I certainly came of age during the AIDS epidemic, you know, kind of was discovering sex and sexuality and all of that with the backdrop of sex can kill you. And,
right.
You know, I do think that that looms very large in my generation, whether you're gay or not gay. You know, it was just so big in it, you know, kind of how we came.
Yeah. No, I think that's, you know, it's like right out there on Wikipedia. So I was saying I'm 40. So I'm born in 1978. And, you know, during my younger childhood, it's all over on the news, on TV, movies start to come out about it at a certain point. It, you know, wasn't part of my immediate personal experience, but it was very much there. And then, you know, I get to high school in the early 90s, and all of sex ed was HIV, HIV, HIV. You know, I think that it's been really interesting to me. People even a little bit younger kind of don't get it because it was just never on their radar. And people a bit older are, you know, quite a few, you know, I don't mean a bit like a year, but, you know, 10 years or so older, seem surprised that it would have been that much a part of my world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like, my gosh, this is one of the most important defining periods and events of the 20th century. It would be like growing up with World War II in the background. You know, you're not there, but it's going on. It's, you know, you're scared, you're tuned in, you're watching the news. That, you know, why would that not be at the center of my early consciousness? And, you know, as a child, you don't have that sense of, oh, I don't have to worry about that. That's happening to those people over there. And you also don't have a sense of, well, they were asking for it, that, you know, a lot of adults managed to come up with. It just, you know, you're a kid. It's just, you're porous. And I think I had an appropriate reaction to it, which is, this is the most important thing that's happening in the world right now. So it's actually just shocking to me that people would be surprised that it would be of interest to me, and I'm shocked that people aren't constantly writing about it and thinking about it and talking about it. You know, these people, you go to someone's house and they have like 17 books about the Civil War on their shelf. and nothing about the AIDS crisis. Like, what is that? Like, why are you, well, a lot more people have died of AIDS, you know, and why do we study history? We study it, you know, we study, for instance, the Civil War so that we learn why America is the way it is now, and so that we don't let things like that happen again. And those are the reasons we should be studying the AIDS crisis. Why the 17 books on the Civil War? I don't get it.
Well, you're opening up quite a can of worms with that observation, but we'll I'll set that aside for a moment. But yeah.
Yeah.
It's, so this two time period structure and one time period informing the other time period, it's interesting because one of the themes that you're touching on now is really what happens when a generation is forced to age ahead of their parents or ahead of the generations before them, given some crisis they've been through. And both of these storylines reflect that. And I was thinking, you know, we're living through another one of those time periods right now with school shootings and children being forced to live through something their parents didn't, and parents not being able to really advise their children on, you know, how to get through it. And I just think it's always interesting to talk about the time period a book is born into and all of the themes that are going on culturally in the world that the book is coming out into and how that piece of work can inform what we're living through as we're living through it. And I just think this is so timely.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I started this book in 2013, 2014. A lot has happened. It's been an interesting ride.
Yeah.
I think I always felt really good that I was working on something intrinsically political, not about the current day, because then you'd have to be adjusting constantly, but something that was going to feel timely regardless of what was happening in the world. Because things like this are always happening in the world. But, you know, at the times when I was, you know, getting really angry, which is a lot of times in the past few years, I was very glad that I wasn't working on, for instance, The 100-Year House, my second novel, which I loved, but it was a little bit campier and more sort of madcap, you know, people having affairs and things. I was really happy that this was the book I was working on now. And of course, I think my book got maybe a little more politicized because of the events of the past few years, just in terms of things like, I think it was always going to be completely innately political, and I'm not setting out to be didactic to prove any one political point, but I could really understand as my characters get involved in ACT UP later in the book and are really out there in the streets protesting, I think I was able to write those scenes better for having been out there recently at some protests in the current day. So, you know, that was helpful. But, I think the very horrifying relevance of this book, and more specifically of the AIDS crisis, which we should be constantly studying, is that murder does not always look like murder. And genocide does not always look like people with machetes. You know, it's going to happen, you know, there can be genocides of neglect, and there are ways that the government or certain politicians can take marginalized populations and get away with literal or de facto murder, and their base will thank them for it. And that is, you know, unfortunately never going to be irrelevant. And, you know, it came clearer and clearer to me in writing this book the extent to which that can go. It was also becoming clearer and clearer to me, you know, in the daily present.
And that, you know, to your point about how effectively you wrote the protest scenes at the end of this, it felt like that. I mean, it really felt like this was being informed by present day, even though the present day was completely off the page, that there was an authoritative voice in the know behind all of this that I think really gave the book even more of a punch than if, you know, it would be an interesting academic exercise to think about writing this book 5 years ago and how different it would have come out. But
right.
I
have to say, the other thing that really helped me in writing those protest scenes was someone has loaded onto YouTube quite a lot of camcorder footage of the 1990 ACT UP demo in Chicago. There's, for people who haven't read the book yet, the scene in question is that most of the ACT UP actions in Chicago were, 30, 40 people. There's this massive one in April of 1990, people flying in from all over the country to protest the American Medical Association, which is headquartered in Chicago, and a lot of insurance companies that are also headquartered there, and also Cook County Hospital. It was a very complicated protest. But this YouTube footage was just astonishing. It's really up close. I'm not quite sure the circumstances in which it was taken. It's very clearly a camcorder, but someone's narrating it as if they're a news anchor, but it's kind of amateur. So I'm not sure what their distribution idea was for this video, or if anyone's really watched it in the years between then and YouTube. Mm-hmm. But I recommend everyone watching it. You feel like you're there. And then I was able to talk to a couple of people who were there as well, including there's just this amazing scene that a thing that actually happened where these five guys got into the county building outside of which people were protesting. They went in straight drag, which means they put on like shirts and ties and they walked in there like they worked there. And then they got out on this ledge and ripped off their shirts, and they had ACT UP T-shirts underneath, and they put this big banner out on the ledge that said, "We demand equal health care now." And then they're dragged in very violently one by one. And you can, I wrote about this. You can see it in the YouTube videos. And then I interviewed a lot of people for this book, and one of the people I interviewed was this activist named Bill McMillan, who was out there on the ledge and is still with us. And did not think he would be, but he's still around, and he, shared his stories with me too. Empathy can only take you so far. There's got to be a lot of research behind it, and there were things I would have gotten wrong if I just tried to imagine my way there. But you need both. You need the empathy and the research.
Well, that's a good point, because I wanted to bring that up, but let's jump to that now. Because this felt so, this novel, even unlike some of your other work, I've loved all of your work all the way along, but this was just at a different level. It was so immersive and so, I often read novels for the show as a writer and an interviewer, and I didn't do that this time. I just was completely engrossed in the subject matter in the story. And then I had to go back and say, okay, now I have to put my interviewer hat on and read it again. But it was so immersive. And I'd love to talk a little bit about, because most of our listeners are writers themselves and it's kind of a craft show, that process of research, what kind of research you did. We've talked about that a little. And then the act of not just doing the research, but then fictionalizing and turning the research into story and narrative. And maybe you can give more examples.
I love talking about this. And I think, this is something that I wouldn't have been ready to do with an earlier novel. My first novel, I was scared to even tell anyone I was writing a novel or that I was writing anything. I think I had to be a little bit farther. For me, I think anyone should feel free to say that, but I needed to be a little farther along to be able to call people up and be like, hey, I'm an author, talk to me. But so here's what happened. I set out thinking, I'm going to start this AIDS research by looking at some of the big books out there. And so I started, looking for books about the AIDS crisis in Chicago, thinking Chicago is the third biggest city in the U.S. There will be books about it, and there's nothing. Mm-hmm. There are a few, there's some coffee table books about LGBTQ Chicago that have pages in them about the AIDS crisis. And there are a couple of, personal accounts, things like that. But you'd think there would be a big comprehensive book of nonfiction on this. And I looked for 5 years and there's nothing. Mm. There also, you look in the index of some of the big books some of the big comprehensive books that are out there, like How to Survive a Plague by David France, Chicago's not even in the index. everything is New York and San Francisco. There are no documentaries. Well, I take that back. There's one very short documentary that's beautiful about the founder of ACT UP in Chicago. It's called Short Fuse, and I managed to see it, but it's very hard to get to see. But, you know, there's not much. So I went online, and I did find online a lot of wonderful archived interviews. The Windy City Times, the Windy City Media Group, rather, in Chicago, which puts out the Windy City Times, which is a gay weekly, they have done a lot of work with, getting essays and interviews kind of transcribed and archived, cataloged online. So that was a good start. My next step was that same newspaper, the Windy City Times, is on archive at the Harold Washington Library in Chicago. So I went there and I read every back issue of that from 1985 to 1992, like every ad, everything. It was fascinating.
Wow.
I could spend half an hour talking just about that. But a lot of other publications from that time, too, but that the archives on that were the most complete. And then meanwhile, I was reaching out to everyone I knew, sometimes, you know, individually, like, hey, I know you lived in Boys Town in the 80s. Can you talk to me about that? I don't think people haven't read the book. I don't think we've mentioned Boys Town. Boys Town is exactly what it sounds like. It's a neighborhood in Chicago. So I was doing that. I was also just putting it on Facebook, like, listen, here's what I'm looking for, you know, anyone in any of these categories. Looking for people who'd been, you know, diagnosed with HIV in the early 80s and were still around. That's, you know, hard to find, obviously, and lots of other categories, too. And then I, you know, began a bunch of sit-down interviews. At first, sometimes with people who were a little farther removed, you know, someone saying, gosh, I moved here in 1992, and I did some work for ACT UP, but I'll talk to you about what I know. But, you know, they're giving me fantastic details. And then at the end of the interview, I'm saying, you know, who are the next three people I should talk to? And they're making introductions, and then those people are making introductions. As an example, at a certain point, I kind of lucked out. I was having drinks with another writer because I was on tour for my story collection, and I was in Colorado, and he came to the reading. We had drinks. And I mentioned the book, and he said, gosh, you know, I used to live in Chicago. My wife is a neurosurgeon, and she worked with these two guys who started the major AIDS unit at Illinois Masonic Hospital there, which I'd heard a bit about. I ended up knowing a lot more than I knew at that point. And he, you know, said, would you like an introduction to them? So he introduced me to these two doctors who, they're married to each other. They married to each other now, were partners at the time, started this, the AIDS unit that I end up writing about quite a lot in the novel. They had me up to their apartment two different times. They were so generous, talked to me for hours. Then they introduced me to this woman who'd been a charge nurse on the unit, who was meanwhile working on a memoir about that time. They introduced me to the art therapist on the unit, and they introduced me to this activist, this woman who, again, I don't want to get started because they'll take over the interview and I'll talk about her for half an hour, but she's amazing. So I met with all of them. The activist, in turn, invites me to this screening of this short film I was just talking about. When I'm there, I reconnect with this guy who's a bookseller who I didn't realize had been big in ACT UP in the day. I interview him. He ends up reading the book for me. It's just, you know, so, just, you know, putting yourself out there and following every lead and, you know, just being, you know, not assuming that you know stuff. I have to say, some, not all, certainly, some of the fictionalized accounts of AIDS I've read, often where it's a subplot in something, you know, larger, it's become very clear to me that they didn't really do research. They're sort of going off of a popular perception, you know, of things they've absorbed from movies, and it's, you know, it's sort of galling, really, that I don't know. I think in this particular case, and I'm sure there is stuff I've gotten wrong, but not for lack of trying. You know, with something this sensitive, you can't just assume that you can guess or assume that you would know. You could be the most empathetic person in the world, and there's just stuff you're going to get wrong. There's one of the things that I caught in my own draft was that early on I have this scene in the book where someone, my main guy, Yale, is walking down the street and he can't find his friends. And I had him looking into the windows of the different gay bars that he was passing to look for them on this one strip where there are a lot of them. And I didn't realize until I was talking to someone, he was talking to me about his memories of the bar scene, that, of course, you couldn't look through the windows of a gay bar in 1985. They would be blacked out. There'd be heavy curtains. I read about this one bar, and I put this in the book, this one bar in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where it was the only gay bar in town, and it was really sad, and there were just all these kind of dying geraniums filling the window, just tons and tons of geraniums to, like, block the view, right? But, it, you know, as soon as this guy said it to me, I'm like, oh, my God, of course. But, you know, I'm thinking, like, I know those same bars. They're still there. I've been in them. But that's not enough. You know, you've got to do the research.
I do think you're hitting on exactly the point of what makes this book feel so different. And it's so, like I say, it's so immersive and you're so caught up in these people's lives. And I think it is all those little details and the dying geraniums and the blacked out windows. It just has a feeling of you're really living through this. And I'd love to talk a little bit about accessing the fictive dream, because I think that's really hard for, especially hard for new writers and the, you know, I mean, we're always told to show, not tell, but accessing this other place that's even, you know, deeper than just telling a scene, but it's, and I think you're right. A lot of this is research. But I'd love to hear kind of about your process of getting to know Yale, of getting to know Fiona, of really understanding who these people are and what makes them tick and what they're afraid of and all of that, kind of your character work. I would just kind of love to hear how you got to know these people.
Yeah. So I did a lot of off-the-page writing, just sort of making myself answer questions about the characters. It's something that I have my students do, but that I'm usually a hypocrite about and don't do myself. Give my students, my adult novel writing students in Chicago, but give them questionnaires of, like, you know, what is this person's kryptonite? What's this person's greatest fear? You know, tell me a secret about this character, that kind of thing. And I actually made myself do it this time, especially in moments where I felt like I was struggling with certain characters. Yale, for some reason, was never a struggle for me. He came very easily. I did struggle with Fiona, and I really struggled with Charlie, Yale's boyfriend, in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give a lot of plot spoilers there, but he's inscrutable in several ways, and I needed him to be inscrutable in several ways, but I also needed to understand him as the author. You know, I needed to know what was going on there. So I did a lot of that, and then this is going to sound super cheesy because this is like the kind of thing that other authors say, and then I just roll my eyes. But when I was really stuck, would try to go for a walk as the character. Mm. It's so cheesy. But specifically, you know, I was walking around Boys Town as it is now. I had mental maps, and I actually had literal maps that I'd made and that a wonderful intern helped me make. I should give him credit. Maps of what businesses were where in 1986, basically, early 1986. You know, so I'm walking by what's now a shoe, you know, DSW shoe warehouse, and being like, that was this, you know, amazing club, and I know all these things about it. Even though I was, you know, way too young to have experienced that. My parents didn't take me bar hopping in the 80s or anything. secondhand knowledge. But just kind of trying to walk around and get my bearings and figure out, you know, what's Yale's building, what's the house he really is looking at, his house he wants to buy. and picking out those places, taking photos, walking around. And as I was doing that, it felt kind of natural to just feel like, I could walk around as Yale and look around at how things had changed, or walk around and pretend that it was still 1985, or that I could walk around as Fiona in the present day, understanding what had happened there and looking at how much had changed. And, my understanding of the city changed drastically in reading this book, that, I'm walking down these streets and it's like walking through a battlefield, not to bring the Civil War back into it, but, all the ghosts around you, and people kind of, I think some people walking around absolutely aware of what happened there, and some people walking around rather oblivious to it. Then that got to be habitual enough for me that I'd be walking in completely different areas. I'd drop my kids off from school and walk to get a coffee, and I'm not in this part of town at all. But whatever character I was struggling with, to just be like, okay, I'm really working on Fiona. I'm just going to go for a walk as Fiona for 5 blocks here and see what happens. And, what's she thinking about? A bird lands in front of her on the sidewalk. What's her reaction? So it's kind of this method acting thing. So super cheesy, like
no,
I said.
I love that. That's the one thing that I noticed early on in the book. I didn't notice it as much later on, but I love the use of lists. Like, I think Fiona spills her purse on the plane, and then we get to see everything that's in her purse. And or they're going to the grocery store, and we get to see the list of what they're going to get. Or, something cheesy. I mean, maybe that's cheesy too, but I think through this reveal of, let's make a list of this character's, what does her closet look like, or what's she, what's she getting rid of, or something like that.
They're not presented in list form specifically in the book, just to be clear, but the sort of, what are the details of what's going on here? What are the physical things? I think that's fun. I don't want to give a spoiler, but there is one chapter in the book that really is written in list form.
Yeah.
When Yale is sort of in a moment of crisis, and that really breaking actual form for me there, and writing it in a completely different format was, I think, important for the way that chapter needed to come out. I'm being super cryptic here.
Sorry. No,
And
I do think that's kind of how the brain functions when it's in crisis. You kind of do. We will say no more, but my guest this morning is Rebecca Mackay. The book is The Great Believers, out and available now. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I know Chicago is your town. Was that always going to be the town, or was there an independent reason for making it Chicago?
It was always going to be the town, just in sort of a vague way. And then I became really vehement about this halfway through. So, I really felt like I wanted to write a Chicago novel, just because, it is my city. I love writing about it. And I've written a lot of short stories that are very much about Chicago. But even though, the 100-year house takes place in the suburbs, but it's very isolated estate, it really doesn't have anything to do with Chicago. I could have told you it was the outskirts of Cleveland, and I wouldn't have had to change a thing. I guess in my first novel, The Borrower, they come through Chicago. There's like half a chapter there. Mm-hmm. But I really love writing about the city. I really wanted to write about it. And so way back when I had my artist model and her art guy, I just felt like, it'll be, he'll be in Chicago and she'll be somewhere else. And that'll be, it'll be a bit of a Chicago story. The fact that when I started researching, I realized how little there was about the AIDS crisis in Chicago, made me feel, a sense of urgency in getting these stories across. And Chicago's reaction to the AIDS crisis was very different than New York and San Francisco. I think, every city had a completely unique reaction in terms of, Chicago had a little bit more time to prepare. It didn't hit its hardest in Chicago until, a year or two after it hit the coasts the hardest. Mm-hmm. And the size and centrality of Boys Town meant that people really knew each other. It wasn't, you know, San Francisco and New York, people were a little bit more spread out. There were more places to be. Chicago, at that point, almost everyone's in basically the same neighborhood. It's big enough that there's a lot of stuff. It's small enough that you actually know people. And so the grassroots reaction was incredible. I also think there's, you know, this is my Midwestern bias, but I think that there's something about the Midwest, too. The, you know, people are just going to take it upon themselves to take care of each other in a way that I'm going to get myself in trouble that might not always be as true on the coast.
It is true. No, you're exactly right.
I'm going to get hate mail now. but, you know, there was something, I think, incredibly heartening for me in learning about Chicago's reaction and in seeing a lot of these organizations that are still around, still staffed by the same people who started them in the 80s, and hearing about things like everyone knew there was this one bar with a slush fund behind the bar, and if you went in and, you know, you had trouble making rent because you'd lost your job because of AIDS or whatever, they would hand you $100. Mm. And people were, you know, always giving money to this just envelope behind the bar. That's, you know, that's amazing to me, at the same time that you have just this massive governmental neglect and massive hatred coming in from all directions. You have incredible compassion and sacrifice and, you know, wonderful stories of just amazing things happening.
It did feel like a novel that could not have happened in San Francisco. You know, I mean, as you're reading it, you're like, would San Francisco be way too overwhelming? All of these people wouldn't know each, you know, it'd be very overwhelming. I mean, there's just too many people. And this felt very, like, contained, and everyone knew each other, and there was a lot of self-care. And it just had a very different texture, I think, than it would have in San Francisco or New York.
Yeah, yeah. That's, you know, I was going for that. And I think it's, you know, it's certainly partly in the details of, you know, literally what was in Chicago. And so some things I fictionalized, a lot of things I didn't. You know, actual organizations being mentioned, the actual protest, the actual, you know, details of the 1987 Pride Parade. Yeah. But it was also vibe for me very much.
So let's get back to some of these minor characters, because there's a, I mean, they're not even minor, but there's a huge cast of people in Yale's life who you get to know through him. Charlie's the best example, but you get to know people through him. But I assume that you as author got to know these people independently on their own, not through Yale. And I'd love to just talk about these wonderful minor characters who felt full and rich and authentic in their own rich lives, even though they weren't on the page as much as Yale may have been, and how you got to know them and how much you felt you needed to know them in order to, or if you got to know them kind of through Yale's point of view.
Yeah, I, you know, it's funny because I feel like I have my A cast, certainly, and then I had like a B cast and a C cast. The C cast would be the people that just, like, you kind of know their name, they appear, they have a few lines, they come back a few, you know, chapters later. I didn't, you know, necessarily invest quite as much in them. But I, my B cast, I was really attached to. So I have these characters who, you know, they're good friends. We might meet them in some cases, not only in the 80s, but again in 2015, or they're people who are just, you know, really central to Yale's life. And I had a lot of fun with them. I originally had way too many people. I think my instinct coming into any new scene, you know, I need a person to fulfill a certain role, so I invent a brand new person every time. So, you know, now I need his friend from work, so it's a brand new friend from work. And now I need this, you know, person that he sees on the street, so it's a brand new person from the street. And then, you know, realized I could go in and combine a lot of those characters. For example, you know, initially Yale's friend who, whose funeral it was at the beginning of the book, was a completely different person from Fiona's brother who had died. And then going, yeah, wait a second, wait, this, you know, I got two people who've already died when the book starts. They could just be the same person. This makes a lot more sense. It's a lot tighter that way. And when I did that, I was often making the characters a bit richer and more complex, because now instead of the one guy who you know, is an aspiring artist, and the other guy who, you know, is part Cuban, and his family, you know, there's this whole thing about that. It's the same guy. There's just more stuff now about the same guy. And so, yeah, I certain of the kind of B-cast characters I was very, very attached to. And it was really a joy for me with the ones who survived to 2015, which is not everyone, to be able to show those characters 30 years apart.
Yeah.
That was really interesting to think about. And part of my thinking about that actually, again, came from my research, these interviews with people who, you know, they're talking to me about what they were like in the 80s, but I'm sitting across from somebody who seems very different from that now. A lot of, you know, a lot of the guys I interviewed were sober now, for instance, because they'd had, you know, they'd been self-medicating in very unhealthy ways in the 80s. And they're talking about, you know, they're telling me those stories, but then they're sitting there and they're really put together. And, you know, it's like, wow, this is quite a change. I think that added to the characters a lot for me, that, you know, it's not just a moment in time, but what is the trajectory on this person and what slices of that am I taking?
What does your office look like? Like, how do you keep track of all? Do you have butcher paper everywhere?
By the end of this project, wasn't even using my office because it was so full of stuff, and I just wrote on my bed. By the end, I like abandoned my office completely. It's really fun. And it's still not like worked out. I the end of this tour, I have to sort it all out and kind of clean it for the next project. I had a lot of. I did have, you know, character maps, like get big sheets of butcher paper and draw Yale in the middle in a bubble and then draw bubbles all around him and lines connecting them. And there's all that stuff. I had a lot of, you know, maps, a lot of notebooks full of interviews, a lot of, you know, just random books that I was buying up. Was buying up everything I could from the 80s in specific. Things like I kept being frustrated with trying to figure out what the medical knowledge had been in, say, 1987, because you look it up now and you're not going to get outdated information on the internet. So I ended up buying, there's this amazing library in Chicago called the Gerber Hart Library that's just kind of LGBTQ history and resources and all kinds of things. And they have a used book section. And I bought up all these books that nobody in their right mind would want, because like I got this 1987 guide put up by Johns Hopkins. It's like a guide to living with HIV. Who the hell wants the 1987 guide to living with HIV? I do. So I have, you know, stacks of these books, but I have to do some cleaning now. I have to probably part with some of these things and figure out who else wants the 1987 guy to living with HIV.
I don't know if you feel this way, but the other thing that struck me throughout the book is the character names. And getting character names just right, I think, is really important to getting to know who they are. And some of these are, you know, incredibly unique. I mean, Yale is unique, but Asher and... You know, some of them are kind of normalish names, but Fiona just felt like the right name for Fiona, and it's unique. And I was just kind of wondering how important character names are to you, and how you land on them, and how you know it fits.
Yeah.
If you struggle with that.
Thanks. I love that question. Nobody's been asking me that. I love thinking about names. I first asked my mom for a baby name book when I was like 16, and she fortunately didn't freak out and just got me one. She just thought, she was like, yeah, you're a writer. Okay. Even just the process of naming my kids, it was like, you know, I hardly planned the nurseries at all, but we spent 9 months, you know, on the kids' names. Hmm. I do remember at one point very early on, sitting, I don't know why I was in a hotel, but I was probably traveling. I was probably traveling for my story collection, and opening a notebook and just making a giant list of men's names that I thought were kind of interesting, because I knew that, if I was going to have a populated novel, I cannot name all my characters Dave and Steve, because no one's going to keep track of them. Apologies to all the Daves and Steves out there. But
yeah.
And Yale was a name that came up on that list. I was just kind of, you know, spitballing, and I put that down, and later came up with a backstory of why he's named that. But, a lot of the names changed a few times. You know, you're trying to come up with a name that works and that's going to, in some small way, help readers remember who that is. So Teddy, for instance, and I think I kind of started with Teddy, changed it a few times and changed it back. Teddy is kind of, you know, Yale calls him a twink at one point. So not my words, Yale's words. you know, he's a little bit, he's small. He's a little bit immature in some ways. And so I think the name Teddy, I've known many very mature, large men named Teddy. That's, you know, but, you know, if you have a kind of small character who's also kind of immature, and then he's named Teddy, that name is going to sort of lock in with those attributes in a certain way, mm-hmm. where that comes back and you're like, yeah, Teddy, I remember who Teddy is. So, you know, it needed to match without being completely on the nose. You know, Julian is just this beautiful, physically beautiful man. And I just think that's it's kind of a romantic name in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I think I have certain names that help you remember. With Asher, I think that's a name that helps you remember that he's Jewish, if nothing else.
Yeah.
you know, like it's just something, right?
Right, right.
There were some, Terrence is this kind of, again, sort of B-cast character. I changed his name like 15 times.
That's
and
funny.
I could not come up with, I wanted a name that, the other thing that kept happening was I would name people things that were too similar to each other. And I'd suddenly realize that I had what did I have? I had something else that was really close to Julian. I might have had a Julia in there at a certain point. Or no, maybe it was like Fiona's therapist was like Juliana. And I was like, it's just too close. No one's going to confuse them, but it's just too close. And I'd finally found Terrence. I got it off the name tag of a grocery cashier. And I was like, that's the name. And then I, at the 11th hour, was like, oh, my gosh, but I have a Teresa and a Terrence. But I just kept them both. And I was like, no one's going to confuse someone's British mom with this young guy. It's going to be fine.
That was the funny thing is I never got confused. And, you know,
I'm
it's a huge cast of characters. And I just felt like I knew these people. And I don't know if it was, you know, little details that you gave to them that made them memorable independent of their names. But I never got confused.
Right. Well, I'm also always trying to remind you in some way of who they are. You know, bring them back up and then right away remind you of some physical trait or the last time that Yale saw them or whatever it is. Maybe just a really distinctive personality trait. Knowing that, gosh, it's a lot of people.
Yeah. The other thing that I want to mention that I don't think has come clear through this interview for people who haven't read it is it's an incredibly suspenseful book. It's one of those books where you want to see what happens next. And managing suspense in, you know, as we're describing it, it doesn't sound like a cliffhanging novel. And it always is. That's hard. That's really hard. And I don't know if you struggled with that as writer, but you couldn't put it down.
I think that there was... You know, certainly plenty of intrinsic suspense in terms of if you're writing about someone, you know, at the height of the AIDS epidemic, there's just a lot of illness suspense of, you know, getting this test and then waiting 2 weeks for the results, having to wait to even get the test, knowing that a friend is sick but not knowing how sick. You know, so there was a lot of that. I couldn't rely only on that, and I didn't want it to get to a point where it felt manipulative in some way. So there was also a lot of manufactured suspense. There is with that, you know, art subplot that I mentioned before, there's a lot of kind of career suspense, you know, trying to figure out if these art pieces are real, trying to figure out if he can acquire them for his gallery. We have suspense with Fiona in 2015 looking for her daughter and not knowing if she's okay. And yeah, no, I think, I guess I don't think in terms of suspense necessarily, but in terms of momentum. Hmm. Always, you know, no matter what I'm writing, I'm always asking, you know, why would someone keep reading at this point? Hmm. You know, what, and your answer, for me, my answer can't be because my language is going to be so beautiful that they won't be able to put the book down, or my characters are so engrossing. It's really got to be, you know, to find out X. What balls are up in the air at this point. I have my students, I don't know if they actually do it, I tell my students to do this exercise where when they're watching a movie at home, to pause it at random intervals, like pause it 40 minutes in, pause it an hour in, pause it half an hour before the end, and ask yourself why you would be upset if the movie ended right now.
Huh.
And the answer is almost always going to be about unresolved plot points. It's going to be about that momentum in some way. You know, like, okay, even if it's, you know, 10 minutes before the end, why would you be upset if it ended right now? And it's like, oh, okay, well, we know that they saved the city from the bomb, but we don't know if they're going to get together romantically. Like, you know, there's something left hanging that's been promised. And if you... You know, if your answer were, I wouldn't be upset if the movie ended right now, I'm completely satisfied, it's fine, and you still got 40 minutes to go, that, there's a problem with that movie. And I'll, you know, I'll tell them to do it with books too, but it's, you know, it's going to take, you know, a week or so to do that with a book. And with a movie, you can think about it a lot more, you know, in the course of one night. So, you know, I'm constantly thinking about that. If I've ever landed at a place in my writing where all issues are resolved, nobody's up in the air about anything, everyone's just kind of sailing along, I've done something really wrong. So I'm making sure that, you know, the, you know, if one, you know, if for instance, if Yale's health issues are settled, that something's going on with his career. And meanwhile, in the Fiona chapter, she's in crisis. And if Fiona's issues are settled and Yale's career is fine, maybe this is when he's worried about his health. You know, something's, you know, you catch one ball, you got to throw another one up.
It's so funny you should say that, because I was going to say what I was worried about as I was reading the book is if I know Yale's outcome at some point, I will lose interest because that's what I care about the most. And then I found out, no, I care about all of it. I care about all of it the most. And so I'm going
right,
to.
Right, right,
and yet
right.
It never really felt manufactured. You know, it never felt like you were trying to throw another ball up in the air. It just felt very organic. And I know, you know, that's just that's the hard part and skill of writing, but so good. It was so good.
Thanks.
God, we're drawing down on our time, but I'd also love to talk about writing discipline. And I know you have two little ones at home and we have all the swirl of the world going on every day bombarding us, and sort of the artist's job in the face of what we're living through right now and the artist's job of discipline. And if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah, I do. I think that I'm terribly undisciplined. My least favorite writing advice is that you have to write every day or you're not a real writer. I think that's bunk. I have a lot of fallow periods. I do a lot of thinking. You know, I don't believe that, you know, writing equals typing necessarily. I do a lot of just thinking about my work. And I'm hugely undisciplined. What makes me get the books written is the very thing we were just talking about. So if you are in suspense as a reader, hopefully you're in suspense as a reader, and that should mean that I am in some kind of suspense as a writer.
Yeah.
I should be returning to the book for the same reasons that a reader should be returning to the book, because I need to get to what happens. I might know what's going to happen, but I should feel that propulsion to get there. And that should come partly from my characters desperately wanting or needing things, where I'm feeling their motivation as my motivation to write. Someone wants something badly enough that that's their propulsion through the book, then I'm going to feel like sitting down and giving them five more pages in the direction they want to go. And I'm going to be caught up in the fun and the suspense, and fun is a weird word to use for this book, but it was fun to write. The intrigue, whatever is going on, I should be feeling that push in my narrative? And if I'm not, if I'm at a place, you know, if I just feel like I don't really want to work on this, it's just, you know, blah, and it's not just me being cranky, but I really feel stalled out, it's probably because the narrative is stalled out. It's probably because I haven't made enough at stake. I don't have enough to write about. And if that's the case, I need to go back to the drawing board and think about, you know, if I don't even want to write this, why would someone want to read this? So I know that's kind of maybe very different than a lot of the advice out there, which is like, you just got to sit there and work on it every day. And you do have to be disciplined. But I don't know, for me, it can be very much about carving out time. I make a lot of use of artist residencies when I can, where I have kind of uninterrupted time. I also need to just, you know, I'll reward myself with food and block off the day and go to the library where it's quiet. And then, you know, and then I'm really not supposed to have food in the library, so I kind of just hold on myself, but you know what I mean? I'll do that stuff. But I think that when people are stuck, when they're stalled out, when they feel like they lack discipline, what they are actually lacking is narrative momentum.
So good. So good. Rebecca Mackay, I love this. I wish we had longer.
Good.
Wonderful.
Me too. It was fun.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
That's all the
Rebecca
time we
Mackay
have
the
for this week. Well, we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. I'm going to be on with the full hour with Alexander Chi. Stay tuned. The great Hobart Taylor is coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks for joining us. Have a great, great day.